Well, in news overnight, after nearly 6 years of civil war, fighting in Syria is set to stop in just a few hours, we are told. Russia and Turkey have agreed on a new ceasefire deal, which they're guaranteeing. It'll come into effect at midnight local time. The agreement introduces a nationwide truce covering the Syrian army and all the main rebel factions. The UN Special Envoy on Syria has already scheduled peace talks in Geneva in February, but Russia says the warring sides are expected to attend peace talks in Kazakhstan. Keir Giles is Associate Fellow of the Russia and Eurasia Programme at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. Keir Giles, good morning. Welcome to RN Breakfast.
Good morning.
The Russian military says fighting between 62,000 Syrian rebels and the Syrian government is about to cease. Who exactly are we talking about? Because there are some groups, some key fighting groups, not included in this ceasefire.
That's exactly right. There's the same problem with this ceasefire agreement as there has been with previous ones, that there's a vague description of those groups that are not included and they're not listed by name. So previously, ceasefire agreements have not stopped the fighting because there are still groups out there that Russia and Syria and Turkey still wish to target. Now, in this particular case, Russia is saying that Islamic State and other groups affiliated with it and the al-Nusra Front are excluded. Turkey is saying that Kurdish groups are excluded as well. So it won't be an end to the fighting overall. However, this ceasefire does have a better chance of ending some of the civilian suffering than some of the previous agreements, which were brokered by the United States and Washington and Russia, which were really just a way for Russia to string the United States along and play for time until the Syrian government was in a better position as it is now.
When you say that this ceasefire plan has a better chance than previous, what is the difference in the detail?
Well, one key point is that all the major players who are actually on the ground in Syria are involved in this. It's been brokered between Russia and Turkey and Iran, and Iranian ground forces, of course, have played a serious role in easing the victory of the Syrian government over the rebels to this point. So with all of their involvement, there's a much better chance that there will actually be a realistic ceasefire, especially now that the Syrian government is in a much better military position and the rebel groups have realized that they are losing badly and need a break.
Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, previously known as the Nusra Front, linked to al-Qaeda, as you say, not party to this. Why does that matter? And why does that have such a big impact in terms of what happens in Idlib province in the north of Syria?
Well, partly because there is no clear agreement between everybody who's observing the conflict as to who exactly is affiliated with this group. So it's a fairly nebulous organization, and that means that fighting can continue with one side or the other claiming that they're acting in accordance with the ceasefire. It's that lack of clarity, that ambiguity of exactly who is covered that has caused previous agreements to break down.
The High Negotiations Committee, which the UN considers to be Syria's main opposition body, has confirmed the deal, which, as we've said, excludes jihadist groups. Will the hostilities against those groups continue? And why have these groups, which, as we understand it, have always said they would only negotiate if there was an acknowledgement that Assad would ultimately have to go, why are they agreeing now when that has not been offered?
I think we're seeing the result of very long and patient work, in particular by Russia, to win round opposition groups to a ceasefire. But also, I think it reflects, as we said a moment ago, the military situation, that they are very much on the back foot and in a much less strong position than they were during previous ceasefire agreements. I think all of these things may play a role.
Obviously, when the Russian ambassador to Turkey, Andrei Karlov, was assassinated, there were enormous concerns that this would destabilize already shaky relations between Turkey and Russia. Did it act counter to that, in fact, and bring them closer together?
I'm not sure it's had that effect. I mean, certainly, the negotiations between Russia and Turkey that were scheduled to happen the next day seemed to be in doubt after the ambassador was shot. But they proceeded, and both sides treated this as not an act of state-on-state violence, as with the case with Turkey shooting down the Russian aircraft almost exactly a year earlier, but something that was not the fault of the Turkish state, and then they pushed ahead with actually getting this agreement going. So it's a very different situation from in the previous year, partly because Russia no longer needed to leverage a crisis in order to extract the maximum concessions from Turkey, because Turkey was already on board with the Russian-backed peace plan.
Is it correct to interpret this as Russia entirely outmaneuvering the United States with regard to Syria? Does the US have any leverage anymore over this conflict?
I think outmaneuvering the United States is a fair assessment. And of course, this goes back not just over the course of these ceasefires and the Russian military intervention in 2015, but right back to 2013, when Russia seized the diplomatic initiative, when it looked as though the United States was about to authorize airstrikes in Syria, and has held it ever since. The United States have been on the back foot all of this time and reacting rather than being proactive about managing the situation and really being strung along by Russia all the way.
In terms of that relationship between Russia and the United States, the big news this morning is that the US has expelled 35 Russian diplomats, closed two Russian compounds in New York and Maryland in response to what the US, or the current US administration, is describing as a campaign of harassment by Russia against American diplomats in Moscow. What is this campaign of harassment we're talking about?
I think calling it harassment is really understating just how unpleasant Russia sets out to make the lives of U.S. diplomats in Moscow. It is a sustained long-term campaign of really being as nasty as possible to them in some really quite extraordinary ways, including, for example, poisoning their pets, breaking into their apartments to, defecate on their carpets, beating them up on the metro, more or less anything you can think of. The really striking thing about this situation is that it has taken so long for the United States to respond, in a similar way that it's taken so long for the Obama administration to respond to Russian hacking attacks that may or may not have derailed the last presidential election. But there seem to have been simultaneous measures taken just today by the United States, both against this diplomatic harassment and against the cyber attacks. There are simultaneously sanctions being announced against some Russian intelligence organizations and individuals.
Do you think this suite of responses from the United States against Russia would be happening now if it were not the case that the Obama administration were handing over to a Trump administration? I mean, is this in part about the domestic politics of the United States and the expectation that Trump is going to be relatively pro-Kremlin?
I think yes, there is an expectation that Trump may possibly be more inclined to favor the Kremlin, but I would not be quite so sure, because at the moment Trump is just as unpredictable to Russia as he is to his own country. But in terms of domestic politics, I think the breaking point has finally been reached, where the Obama administration finally at long last realized that inaction to respond to the unpleasant measures that Russia was taking was only encouraging Russia to go further and further and be more blatant in the aggressive maneuvers that it was undertaking against the United States. So in a way, it's too little too late, but we have at least seen the start of some kind of pushback from the US to rein in Russian behavior.
Keir Giles, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Keir Giles is Associate Fellow of the Russia and Eurasia Program at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. It is 7:45. You're listening to RN Breakfast.